Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwen Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Signal-Reed, and our guest this week, Linda Hutzel-Manning. Each week at this time, we visit with an author, an editor, or a publisher from our region. We hope to find out a little about his or her life, ask what prompts them to write, and perhaps have an opportunity to hear them read from their work. This week, we're very pleased to have Linda Hutzel-Manning return to make another show with us. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Linda is a well-known Coburg author who grew up here attending elementary school in Baltimore and high school in Coburg. She dreamt of a career in the performing arts and went to Ryerson to study. However, the program was a disappointment, so she left to marry and attend Toronto Teachers College. After graduating, she and her husband traveled back and forth across Canada as James was installing computers on the NORAD Pine Tree radar line. It was during this time that to obtain her permanent teacher's certificate, she taught at SS No. 2 Hamilton Township, a one-room school just west of Coburg, for 2 years. When her husband's career took them to Guelph, she studied for a BA in English Literature while bringing up her 3 children. When she graduated in 1975, she began writing full-time. In the years since then, Linda has written award-winning poetry, juvenile fiction, novels, plays, and short fiction, as well as articles for newspapers. But today, we want to ask Linda about her recent and current writing and the new project she has on hand. So, Linda, let's start with your play, A Certain Singing Teacher. Now, Felicity and I both attended the very successful reading of this play by the VOS at Victoria Hall recently. But tell us a little bit about the play itself and how you came to write it.
Sure. I wrote it in the 80s, in the 1980s. And I had had 3 children's plays professionally produced and then published, which is what you have to have an equity cast or part of an equity cast do your play before they will publish it. And I guess I was feeling, you know, sort of confident about playwriting, so I thought I'd try an adult comedy. And I wrote this adult comedy. I sent it out to about 30 professional theater companies across Canada. You put in a self-addressed stamped envelope the old-fashioned way. There was no internet. Not one of them got back to me. So I lost all my self-addressed stamped envelopes. And at that point, I was on to something else. And I just put it away and said, forget, this is ridiculous. I'm not, you know, I think you have to be in theater to get anywhere in theater, so I'm just not going to deal with it. And then it's almost 4 years ago, I talked to Joel Vardy, who is the president of VOS Theater Company in Coburg. And I said, do you think you might be interested in doing this play? Would you show it to B. Quarry, who's a professional director out of Peterborough, who had been doing some work with them? So he said he'd give it to B. Now, I didn't give him a self-addressed stamped envelope or my biog or anything. I just gave him the play. And then, of course, nothing happened. And then 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, I thought, this is crazy. I mean, every once in a while I think of it and I think, I should ask about that play. By this time, I didn't see Joel anymore. I used to see him regularly, and I didn't see him anymore. So I thought, well, and they had started this play reading series. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go to the play reading series, and I'm going to introduce myself to this B. Quarry, because I'd never met her, and I'm going to ask for my play back. Well, when I went to the play reading, it was somebody from the Oshawa area, and she had all her family and friends there. And after the play was over, everybody was talking about her play, and B was talking to people about her play, and I just thought, no, I can't go up and whine to this B Quarry and say, you've got my script. So I thought, I'm going home. So I was just going to go home. And just as I went to leave, Joel, who was one of the readers, was standing at the door. And I said, great job, Joel. And he said, hey, you know, remember that play of yours that you gave to me? I don't suppose you'd be interested in us doing a reading of it like this. I said, well, yes, Joel, I would be interested. Well, he said, we've been just talking about your play and thinking we'd like to do it next year. So that's how it happened. And I read it over. I hadn't read it for, maybe 10 years. And I wasn't terribly impressed. And I got really terrified, and I thought, I don't think it's funny, and it's supposed to be funny, and what if it's not funny? But it is funny. Like, it went over really well, didn't it? I was just flabbergasted at how well it went over. And, of course, there's a lot of stage business that couldn't be done. And it's funny. It makes it even funnier. So I know it'll work. So now neither the VOS nor the Northumberland Players have made a commitment, but I'm giving, I think, the VOS first dibs on it because they went to the bother of doing the play reading, and I would have never even considered anything with it ever. It was a dead manuscript, you know? So this is quite amazing. So I just have to wait and see.
Well, then maybe in the meantime, you'll have to get back to your fiction. In 2011, you published the novel That Summer in Franklin, and you had plans to write a sequel. Now, I know you've recently completed a novel called The Tangling of Years. So is this, too, about Hannah and Colleen?
It is and it isn't. The two main characters, I took two of the other characters, and it's really about Sarah. And her friend Deandra, who's a very damaged soul from too much therapy and shock treatments in the 50s and 60s. Anyway, and Hannah and Colleen and the reporter Alan, who is now the managing editor of the newspaper, of course, they remember what happened that summer in Franklin. And then Larry disappeared. He was only 16 then. At the beginning of this novel, he comes back, and Deandra is now living with Sarah. She's actually looking after her, and he comes back and starts wooing his mother that he's going to take her back and do all these wonderful things for her, but Sarah's sure that he's just after her money, which of course he is.
So it is a sequel because we're going to the same place, and we have some of the same characters, just a different POV.
But I do enough recapping that you can easily read the second one without.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I do enough recapping. Yeah, I did that deliberately.
So tell us a little bit more about the new book. Have you got a publisher for it yet?
Well, I sent it to Second Story, and I was very excited about it because the editor there, they've taken on another editor, Catherine Cole. I knew her quite well because I worked with her with two of my children's books several decades ago. And she wanted to see the whole thing, and that was great. And 2 weeks later, they rejected it.
Oh, dear.
And apparently she and the other editor, Carolyn Jackson, both wanted it. She said she was terribly disappointed they wanted it, but the rest of them said it was too soft.
Oh.
So I spent quite a bit of time and made up the requirements for 6 Canadian agents, literary agents. And they all said that it would be at least 12 to 15 weeks before they got back to me. And the Cook agency got back to me in 20 days and said they wanted to see the whole manuscript.
That's wonderful.
A week. Yeah, well, it's wonderful, but it's it's one of those wait-again situations. So we'll see what happens.
Well, good luck.
Yeah, that's about it.
Would you perhaps read a little bit from The Tangling of Years?
Sure. I'm reading from the first chapter. It's from Sarah's point of view. As dust billows from the gravel driveway and the red sports car disappears onto the highway, Sarah sits rigid in her chair, numb with disbelief and anxiety. Even here on the shaded back deck, the afternoon June sun and humidity render everything damp and uncomfortable. She moves slightly to unstick her caftan from the lawn chair seat, wipes a sleeve over her moist forehead. "I'm probably overreacting," she says aloud. "He's her son, after all. He won't do her any harm." Counter-arguments pummel her brain. His 40-year track record, abysmal. This sudden interest in his mother, suspect. His unexpected appearance, decked out like an aging playboy, outrageously insincere. Sarah stands and stares for a moment at the driveway, the bordering lawn, this tranquil country place so right for Deandra, for both of them in their so-called declining years, perfect until 30 minutes ago when Larry Moran sailed in, announcing he was here to take his dear mother out to lunch. She knows she must find something engrossing to do, otherwise she'll be checking her watch every 5 minutes. They'll be gone 2 hours at least, maybe three. And unless she creates a distraction, she'll be pacing and working herself into a lather, likely to erupt negatively when they do show up, if they show up. But of course they will. She returns to the cool of the kitchen and begins compulsively tidying dishes, flyers, old mail that needs to be filed. It's a matter of tricking the mind into thinking the task at hand is of paramount importance. It works momentarily until the sheer gall of his sudden unannounced appearance wells up in her again, and she slams down the mail she's been sorting and heads for the living room. The look on Deandra's face, seeing her son after all these years, delight, adoration, gullibility, Sarah thinks. She fluffs the couch cushions a bit more fiercely than necessary, knocking a book onto the floor. The book reminds her of Hannah, book club acquaintance and now good friend. I could call her, she thinks, see what she makes of it all. She puts the novel on the side table next to the phone and dials Hannah's number. Hannah? The response is guarded. Yes? It's Sarah. Sarah, I'm so sorry. I always suspect telemarketers during the day. Hannah, can you come over? I need some advice. Of course. Has something happened? Sarah knows she pauses too long and realizes her hand is shaking. I'd rather tell you when you get here. I'll leave right away then. Bye. Funny, Sarah thinks. I didn't intend to ask her over. I'd better put the kettle on. Obviously, I'm more rattled than I realize. The minute Hannah's car appears in the driveway, though, Sarah is on her feet. She rushes down the steps, and they meet as Hannah's car door slams shut. Sarah knows she must look disheveled, that Hannah will suspect trouble with Deandra. Are you all right? A day of unpleasant surprises, Sarah replies. Come, I'll get the tea I've made, and we'll sit on the back deck, cooler there. She walks briskly back and into the kitchen, feeling a little better already. Is it Deandra? Hannah asks as she reappears with the tea tray. Sarah pours for both of them before replying. Larry arrived around noon and took Deandra off. I have no idea where. Sarah stirs and stirs her tea, staring at it as if expecting some explanation. Larry Morand? Her son Larry? Hannah inhales sharply. How is this possible? How would he even know his mother was here? He wrote to me several months ago, Sarah begins, still staring at her tea. Said he wanted to get back in touch, make amends. He had your address? The hospital did, in Ohio. He must have contacted them. She turns her head, takes a deep breath. First a letter and then several phone calls. Each time I put him off talking to his mother, saying she was sleeping, not well. I didn't know what to do. I suspected Larry was more interested in her money than well-being, but in spite of this, I felt obliged to mention the phone calls. Deandra's response was always the same, adoring look, hands twisting in that familiar way, voice a little shaky, litany of hope, anticipation, to see her son again after all these years. So he just showed up? No warning? No warning. Red convertible sports car, navy blazer, too much aftershave, too much charm.
Thanks, Linda. We've been chatting with Linda Hutzel-Manning, a local author and playwright, and we'll continue our conversation after this short break.